a city of 19 million engulfed in terror.
I've never seen anything so horrid. It almost felt as if Mumbai was being attacked, as if it was war. And suddenly, you could see a large number of people frantically running helter-skelter on the road.
Terrorists in Mumbai, India, target hotels and tourists in a series of raids that have been as bloody as they have been daring. The shooting hasn't stopped, and the reasons behind the attacks still not clear. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, November 27th. Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. Adora Udoji is celebrating her Thanksgiving away today. It's a quiet holiday weekend here in the U.S., but we're going to get right to the headlines. And this story just breaking out of Baghdad, Iraq's parliament has approved a security pact setting a deadline for American troop withdrawal. Squabbling between Sunnis and Shia held up the vote, but American troops now officially have 3 years to leave Iraq. Terrorist attacks have crippled the Indian city of Mumbai. The city, formerly known as Bombay, is under curfew after gunmen stormed buildings, luxury hotels, a train station, a Jewish organization's headquarters. They've taken hostages in several buildings. This man escaped after a scary ordeal.
The gunman told us to go up the stairs, up the fire escape stairs, about 30 of us all together. So we're walking up each flight of stairs, and then he stopped us after two or three flights and told everyone to put their hands up and said, "Where are you from? You know, are there any British or Americans here? Show us your ID." And
so that was one Alex Chamberlain who escaped the violence in Mumbai. Femi Oke is here. What's the latest?
The latest in Mumbai. More than 100 people are known to be dead, with hundreds more injured. The White House says that there are no known American people dead. Right now, gunmen are holed up in several buildings with dozens of hostages, including Americans. And there have been several rounds of gunfire and explosions as Indian commandos attempt to take the buildings back from the militants. Some hostages have escaped. The highly coordinated attacks hit multiple locations, and a previously unknown group claims responsibility. We'll go to Mumbai in just a moment to get more information on this breaking story.
And about all we know, the consensus is that this is a Fedayeen attack, which suggests Islamic militants. But as you said, the name of the groups is unfamiliar to anyone.
And apparently they had emailed media outlets to say that they were responsible, which is why we have their details.
So development in Thailand, oddly enough.
State of emergency after anti-government protesters have shut down two airports. The cabinet has just approved the emergency order for the area around the airfield, and it allows the military to crack down and bans public protests. Cancelled flights there have left thousands of tourists, including many Americans, stranded in Bangkok International Airport for Thanksgiving. And in Afghanistan, at least four people are dead after a car bomb exploded near a Thanksgiving event at the American embassy in Kabul. The embassy says that its employees are doing okay.
All right. So thank you, Femi. And get your mind off of all this. It is Thanksgiving. Go back to cutting vegetables. What food are you going to leave untouched on today's holiday table?
Oyster and chestnut dressing. Not together, but separate entities. I can't stand either one. What's wrong with giblet dressing, sage? Happy Thanksgiving to you guys and your families.
She'll have the potatoes. What are you eating and what are you thankful for and what are you leaving behind on the table at 877-8-MY-TAKE?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
At this hour, the consensus among analysts and witnesses in the financial capital of India, Mumbai, is that this is an attack by Fedayeen militants, Islamic militants. It's unfolding as of early evening yesterday and is still continuing this morning. Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now from our partner, the BBC, is Nazis Afroz, who's the BBC's South Asia editor. He's in London. Also with us is one of the witnesses of what happened in Mumbai yesterday, is Malini Agarwal. Agarwal from Radio 1 Mumbai, also from our partners, the BBC. Both join us now. Let me begin with you, Nasis Afroz. What can we say about the nature of this external threat, even as it is being sort of confronted moment to moment in Mumbai as we speak?
It's very difficult to pinpoint and say that this threat was external. The group that has claimed responsibility, we do not know anything about it. There was only one email from this so-called group from one television channel in India. And we never heard of this outfit before. So it's very difficult to say that this is external.
It is, though, Islamic in a sense. I mean, we've heard over and over again that this is obviously Islamic. This is obviously a Fedayeen attack. I mean, I don't know what to make of that sense of certainty. What do you make of it?
Even if it is Islamic, we have seen such attacks in India before. In the city of Mumbai in 1993, there were a series of attacks. And those attacks, the people who were responsible for them were Muslims from Mumbai, and it was Indian Muslims. And they were quite aggrieved about the Hindu-Muslim clashes just preceded those blasts. And they were aggrieved and they just wanted to take the law in their own hands, and they organized this series of blasts in 1993. In the last 2 or 3 years, we have seen some major attacks in India, in the capital Mumbai, in the capital Delhi. We have seen in the very big tourist state Rajasthan. We have seen it in Gujarat. And in everywhere, the authorities said that they were Muslims, but not necessarily they were Islamist group from outside.
Well, we have spoken with a number of people who suggest that there's been a security lapse in Mumbai. Again, I don't know how to put that in context. What do you make of the sense that the police maybe have dropped the ball here and that this was something that they didn't have enough vigilance about and could have been prevented?
Well, it's so difficult for the security agencies to ensure security for a city like Mumbai. It's a huge city. It has a population of nearly 20 million. So how do you ensure security for these people? And for these places, for the big hotels, railway station, airports, yes. So at the same time, if you do not have specific human intelligence, it's very, very difficult. Also, we know for some time the Indian security forces, Indian agencies, they are quite short-staffed. We have a piece of statistic which actually tell us that they're understaffed. There are 25 to 30% jobs, 30% posts which are vacant.
Wow.
In the police forces all over India.
Well, Nasis, I know that you have to go. I don't want to hold you up here, but Nasis Afroz, BBC South Asia editor, definitely giving us a sense of the complexity and the context of the initial reports of what this attack is all about and whether it's external or internal. Thank you for joining us. Also with us is Malini Agarwal from Mumbai, from Radio 1, also part of our partner, the BBC. Malini, you witnessed what happened yesterday. How much of this do you think is crossing some kind of terrorist threshold in Mumbai, or is it more a string, one in a series of attacks that may be different in character, but are a part of a long-standing sense of conflict in India?
You know, the thing is that Mumbai is no stranger to, of course, terrorist attacks, which is a terrible thing, but that's a fact. But I have to say, something was very different about yesterday and chilling to the core. I mean, I was actually out to a club and I was supposed to meet a friend at the lobby of the Trident Oberoi. But last minute, I changed my plans and decided to meet him across the road at the club directly. And as he pulled up, I was waiting for him downstairs. And we saw what we thought were fireworks, and we heard sort of the sound and the sparks, and we made nothing much of it. And as a joke, actually, I said, it was either fireworks or gunfire, and we should go upstairs. And we did. And then upstairs, we were part of this party, and suddenly we felt two large tremors, which I later found out were the grenades that set the fire at the Oberoi Trident. And the thing is, the fact that there are actually these young 20-year-old, terrorists who are running around with AK-47s, Mumbai has never seen terrorism of this nature. We've sort of grown accustomed, sadly, to bombs in, you know, cars and in suitcases and in trains, but there's been no encounter face-to-face with these people. And then you look at them and they're so young. And I was talking to some people who were also at the Taj. I have friends who run nightclubs, and he was saying he had seen the same people walk in plain clothes, like, earlier in the evening, and had commented to the manager saying that, wow, that guy looks a bit shady. And it's just so shocking because it's also in the face of a different set of the society in Mumbai. Because as I'm sure you know, there's a great divide. There's the rich and the haves not have nots. And very often these things happen and they're overlooked by the media and they're overlooked by, unfortunately, people who are not affected by it. But this time it's sort of struck at the heart of media and attention and at, you know, of course, tourists and the people who are better off, who are at these, you know, expensive places and at the, you know, the five-star hotel. And initially, we would have all thought that's probably the safest place to go in the state of emergency. But now you don't know where. I mean, the places that were targeted were Metro Cinema, which is a very popular multiplex cinema. There's BT Station, which is very well known. There were, you know, the JW Marriott, Ramada, all five-star, seven-star hotels. And then there was a place called Leopold, Cafe Leopold in Colaba, which is actually known as a great tourist hangout. It's also in all the guidebooks. So it's very unprecedented, this sort of singled out attack done by these very young looking, very normal looking boys.
Well, Malini, you know, Nazir Afroz a moment ago suggested that the scale of Mumbai, a city of 19 million, makes it an almost impossible task for security forces to keep a handle on the couple of things that you alluded to, young people wandering around with weapons, the idea that there might be some sort of class struggle issue going on here between the haves and the have-nots in a city where there is a large disparity between the rich and the poor. You know, how much of this can be blamed on the scale of the security problem in Mumbai versus something that is fundamentally new?
You know, the thing is exactly what you're saying. I think that we're looking in the wrong direction here. Instead of trying to play the blame game, instead of blaming someone, why don't we try to identify the root of the problem? What is the problem here? And the thing is, with terrorism, I don't think that you can really, I can't hold the army and the police and the National Guard at fault, because how do you really tackle a situation like this? Who would expect in the middle of, you know, busy Bombay on a Wednesday night, two boys will show up with AK-47s and storm in? Okay, how did they get those guns? How did they end up there to begin with? Those are questions we should ask. But how do you control this? How do you accommodate and, you know, prepare for situations like this? I think the bigger problem is trying to figure out who, you know, what is causing these boys to turn to this and find an alternative.
And, of course, who else is watching what's happened? I mean, if, as you say, it only takes a few boys with AK-47s wandering onto the streets on a Wednesday night in Mumbai to shut down a city of 19 million and to transmit headlines all over the world, that certainly is an invitation for any number of groups who have political agendas.
Absolutely. And that's what I was saying. I was like, you know what? Their deed is done. The terror that they inflict and the feeling of fear that they have instilled was that was the terror they were looking to instill. It wasn't so much, I'll blow up this building or I'll set this on fire. They're launching grenades from inside a hotel, you know, or from one room to the other. This whole, you know, jumping from one building to the other. They're obviously on some sort of mission to prove something and do it in the limelight and get all this attention for it. So it's obviously to basically show themselves in this light and get this attention. And the sad thing is that it's just completely unprecedented. Mumbai was not prepared for this. We don't even know what we're fighting about.
Any sense of the condition of the hostages at this point before we go quickly?
You know, I have some good news. 10 hostages were released, and they actually look in very good shape for what they've been in. They seem unharmed. They look quite stunned, as, of course, expectedly they would be. But I saw 10 of them walk out. They were actually all foreign nationals from the look of it, and they are actually making major headway. Unfortunately, the fire at the Taj is still out of control. It's spread to several rooms, and it's been blazing for a while. And the real pity is that it's in the Heritage Wing, which is sort of an icon for Mumbai. And we really hope that they can get that under control, because it's heartbreaking to see the Taj burn like this.
I know it well. Well, Malini Agarwal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Malini Agarwal is in Mumbai. She's a presenter at Radio 1, and she was caught up in the attacks last night. Here's another voice from the very tense situation in Mumbai, with possibly a happy ending there.
Two of the men at one end kept opening the doors, which was absolutely terrifying, and going back out and coming back in, and they were saying there was a dead body outside the bathroom, and also they were seeing people getting shot in the hallway.
All the details from Mumbai through the morning on The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Well, depending on your view of history, the holiday of Thanksgiving is either a commemoration of an event that changed North America for the better or for the worse. But the idea of Thanksgiving itself, of reaching across the table, of being thankful for the good things that have happened throughout the year, and particularly around harvest time, actually has a very important scientific basis in making us all feel better. It's going on inside of us, mentally, physically, and here to talk about research, interesting research into the scientific, biological basis of Thanksgiving itself is Jeffrey Froese, an assistant professor of psychology at Hofstra University. Jeffrey is in the studio with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, Thanksgiving is something that feels good every year because you're with family and you're eating food that you remember. That's really not what your research focuses on. It focuses on this idea of being grateful as a continuing sort of behavior and the benefits that accrue if you do that. How do you design an experiment to measure that sort of thing?
Well, the one particular study that we did was we had students count blessings, which is essentially focusing on the things that they're thankful or grateful for. And we had them journal that daily for 2 weeks.
Journal it. Actually write it down.
You know, I'm thankful for my mother, I'm thankful for my father, things of that sort. They did that for 2 weeks daily, and then we followed them up 3 weeks later to see the benefits. And we found that students who counted blessings reported feeling more optimistic, more satisfied with their lives, more school satisfaction, and actually the trend for being more satisfied with school not only occurred immediately after the experiment, but actually lasted up till 3 weeks later.
And what are the percentages? I mean, how radically different did the two groups report their different feelings?
The effect sizes that we would refer to it as were small to medium, which is typical for personality and social psychology research.
Any sort of specific physiological impacts?
We didn't measure that, but we did notice that there were trends to suggest that students who counted blessings were less likely to report headaches, stomach aches, pains in the body, things of that sort.
There's a broad literature emerging in science and psychology that is attempting to measure the benefits of certain consistent behaviors, like, for instance, praying at night, being thankful for this and that. And there are some pretty surprising findings, right?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's beyond feeling good and beyond happiness. You know, even with our adolescent research, we found that grateful kids tend to, again, report less physical complaints. But also in the adult literature, you know, really pioneered by Dr. Bob Emmons and Mike McCullough, they found that grateful people, again, who counted blessings, were more likely to exercise, more likely to report better sleep, less likely to report these physical complaints. There's even some research done where looking at when you have a sense of appreciation, your heart rhythms are actually more coherent and smooth, which, of course, is healthy.
And is this a cause and effect kind of thing where being grateful produces these effects, or is being grateful an indicator that you, in broad terms, behave more healthily on a lot of different levels?
Well, at this point, because there have been numerous experiments that have been done, we are able to kind of draw that causal link because people were randomly assigned to these conditions. So it does seem like gratitude does indeed cause some of these benefits, but at this point, there are only 9 intervention studies looking at gratitude, so more of the evidence suggests that there's a relationship between gratitude, well-being, relational strengthening, and things of that sort.
What's the most surprising result that you've seen in the sense that, you know, maybe feeling good about oneself, you know, morally is going to produce some sort of physiological benefits, but specifically oriented towards being grateful, recognizing positive things that come to you?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind isn't so much surprising, but I think it's interesting, especially given the times, you know, of our society right now. But grateful people are definitely a lot more less materialistic than ungrateful people. And not only has that been found in adults, but again, we're finding that in children as well.
Well, that'll be very convenient for these times.
Exactly.
Particularly for this holiday.
Right.
So in an economic downturn, we're all in for some major health benefits of gratitude, assuming we can focus our energies properly.
Right, exactly. And the name of the game is focus is being thankful for what you have, not necessarily focusing on the things that you don't have. That's the bottom line.
You know, people describe, in hindsight, the Depression generation as being more healthy and more sort of focused on what really matters. And, of course, they might not remember those times in the same way. They might go, it was miserable. I was glad to get out of it. Part of your research is suggesting that adversity and dealing with situations that cause you to be thankful does have a health benefit that maybe accrues much, much later in life.
Sure. Well, in his latest book, Thanks, How the New Science of Gratitude Can Make You Happier by Dr. Emmons, he actually suggests that in one of the 10 ways to become more thankful, it's in the trying times when you really need to focus on it, not so much when things are going so well. And they have done some pretty good studies in adults where they've looked at people pre and post 9/11, and only second to compassion, gratitude is actually the most highly reported emotion following that.
And the emotion can be generated by doing very simple things: journaling, simply saying prayers, simply acknowledging on a daily basis a sense of gratitude.
Right, exactly. If you think about it, it's really only a couple seconds, a couple minutes a day that some of these studies are suggesting, which is pretty impressive considering that we have all these other factors going on, such as personality factors, genetic factors.
Well, Jeffrey Froh, thank you. Jeffrey Froh is an assistant professor of psychology at Hofstra University. And if you have Thanksgiving and maybe Thanksgiving football on your mind, we have a web-only bonus, a Thanksgiving interview with one-man tailgate party, Jeff Beresford Howe, our pal. You can find that on our website and in this morning's podcast. Now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Indian security forces are working to take control of two luxury hotels and a Jewish center in Mumbai. They were seized by gunmen in the series of terrorist attacks around the city. Hostages are still inside some of the buildings. The BBC is reporting that a gunman in one of the buildings has contacted an Indian TV channel to say he acted in response to the killing of Muslims by Indian troops in Kashmir. The militant Muslim group Deccan Mujahideen claimed responsibility for the attacks. Indian authorities haven't heard of the group and can't confirm that they are definitely responsible. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari has telephoned the head of the Indian National Congress to condemn the attacks. He said the killing of innocent people was, and I quote here, a detestable act. The attacks left more than 100 people dead. The Iraqi parliament has approved a security pact that will allow US troops to stay in the country until 2011, and arguments between the rival factions delayed approval. The verdict for a landmark cyberbullying trial is in. Jurors convicted a Missouri woman, Lori Drew, on three misdemeanor charges of computer fraud, but they rejected stronger felony charges. Drew was charged with creating a phony account on MySpace to torment a teenage girl who later committed suicide.
It's an amazing case.
It certainly
is. A little scary.
Yeah, and it's it makes it very clear that the social networking sites aren't above the law, beyond the law. And the trial took place in Los Angeles because it's where MySpace is
based. And if it happens in society, it happens on social networking sites, I guess. That's right.
That's a look at stories making news this morning, John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Thanksgiving Day. Of course, the idea is to get together and to be communal. It can be a pretty chilly affair if your family is not on speaking terms, of course. But if there are no crises and everyone is really happy to be together once more, eating at the communal table, All that food will certainly help the bonding, but it turns out the most powerful sensations are the warm smells of the holiday feast. It's all those familiar and rich smells of turkey, stuffing, pumpkin pie that bring the experience back. And it turns out there's quite a lot going on in the brain on Thanksgiving Day, no matter how bloated and passed out you might feel. Jonah Lehrer, author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist and editor at Seed Magazine, is our partner, is at our partner WGBH in Boston in the studio to talk about the science behind our olfactory nostalgia regarding Thanksgiving. So, Jonah, what's going on in the brain when you smell all those familiar great kitchen Thanksgiving smells?
Well, you're being bombarded with memories of Thanksgiving's past. From the, you know, one of my favorite smells is the smell of marshmallows melting into sweet potatoes. And that to me cues up a very, very vivid memory of Thanksgiving. And I think about all the Thanksgivings I experienced as a child. And it's a unique type of memory. And scientists are just beginning to understand that, sure enough, our sense of smell and taste are uniquely nostalgic. They are uniquely sentimental, and that they do bring back this rush of memory like no other sense.
You know, I've noticed that anecdotally in my own life. I mean, I can have all kinds of memories, but it's one of those smell memories that really just brings the tears or causes the laughter or really takes you back to the moment when you were really there.
Scientists refer to this as the Proustian hypothesis, after the French novelist who, in that famous scene when he's dipping the cookie in the lime flower tea, all of a sudden he recovers these vivid childhood memories. And for the first time, they can actually explain why this occurs. And it turns out that the olfactory cortex, which processes the sense of smell and taste, is the only sense that's directly connected to the hippocampus, which is the center of long-term memory in the brain. All your other senses first go to the thalamus and then the hippocampus. So these senses literally have this more direct, more primal connection to your brain's memory center. And that seems to be why the smell of marshmallows and sweet potatoes, or the smell of turkey stock, or whatever your favorite nostalgic Thanksgiving smell is, brings back this specific flood of memory.
So your nose is really hardwired to the database of all the old girlfriends and great warm memories of mommy and the Thanksgiving feasts.
Absolutely. And this is a good thing when it comes to pumpkin pie and Thanksgiving. It's a bad thing when, of course, you smell the perfume of your ex-girlfriend. But the sense of smell is uniquely nostalgic because of this weird anatomy of the brain.
Why are certain smells on Thanksgiving particularly evocative, or they seem almost beyond food? I mean, gravy is something that would seem to be rather disgusting, yet you just fall in love with it again and again every Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, gravy is one of my favorite foods to kind of analyze from the perspective of science, because at first glance, it seems completely disgusting. I mean, it's these burned bits of protein stuck to the bottom of the pan, and you add this murky brown liquid to it and scrape up all those burned bits of protein, and somehow it congeals into this delicious, delicious sauce that to me, when I smell a good gravy, I just start to drool. You know, the idea of those pan drippings, and yet they are pan drippings. And so to me, that's one of these great mysteries. Why is gravy so delicious? And it's only in the last couple of years that science has actually been able to explain why we find gravy, or really any of these pan sauces, so titillating to the tongue.
Well, why is it?
Well, it has to do with the fifth taste sensation. So for a long time, ever since the ancient Greeks, we've talked about the four basic classic taste sensations:
salt,
sweet, sour,
sweet,
salty,
yep,
and bitter.
Right.
And now, for the first time, scientists are talking about a fifth taste sensation, which is often referred to as the taste of umami.
Or umami?
The taste of glutamate. The taste of umami. It's named after a Japanese chemist, Kikuna Ikeda, who was the first one in the beginning of the 20th century to hypothesize the idea of a fifth taste sensation. But it turns out that the tongue actually has several different taste receptors which respond and only respond to the sensation of glutamic acid. And that's an amino acid prevalent in all of life. And it turns out that when you cook meat and when you burn it in the bottom of the pan, all those burned bits of protein are densities of umami. They're densities of glutamic acid.
So,
and so that's what the tongue's responding to.
So the tongue is evolutionarily equipped to respond to proteins.
Absolutely. You know, and that makes perfect sense. You know, we're sacks of protein and water ourselves, so we're always needing this protein refill. So the tongue has just learned to love what the body needs in that sense.
So why do we eat so much on Thanksgiving? Is it because we're just like umami addicts, umami freaks on that day?
Well, you know, that's a pretty good theory. That's why you can drown anything in gravy. You could drown your shoe in gravy, and it tastes pretty good.
Mm.
That's because gravy is this umami bath.
Dem's good eating.
But a brand new paper in Neuron recently found they did a very clever experiment involving mice that can't taste sweet. These are mutant mice who are missing the sweet taste receptor. And what they found was that these mice, even though they couldn't taste sweetness, still preferred water with sugar in it. So at first glance, that makes no sense. If you can't taste sugar water, why would you prefer sugar water? Why wouldn't you just drink normal water?
Well, they're somehow detecting the calories.
Exactly. What the scientists found through some clever experimentation was that simply ingesting calories, simply absorbing energy via your mouth, triggered this rush of dopamine, which is a molecule, which is a neurotransmitter that monitors pleasure, in the brain of the mice. So there was something inherently pleasurable about eating calories, even if you couldn't taste it. And that, to me, explains why sometimes you'll be eating something, you know, some really dry piece of turkey, and the gravy's run out, and you're like, why am I eating this really dry piece of turkey? And it's simply because the mere act of ingesting calories is pleasurable.
Where are you getting your dopamine on Thanksgiving, Jonah? Quickly.
I'm getting my dopamine at a family friend's house in Boston. We'll be eating some deep-fried turkey.
Great. Jonah Lehrer, editor-at-large for Seed Magazine and author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Thanks so much, and happy Thanksgiving, Jonah.
Same to you.
And happy Thanksgiving to you, Femi Okeh, here with the
headlines. Thank you so much, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. We're looking at pictures, seeing some pictures from Indian television showing that it looks like Indian forces are about to move into one of the luxury hotels in India. Armed gunmen have attacked at least 10 locations in Mumbai in a series of coordinated attacks, more than 100 people dead and many more wounded. The targets included a train station, a Jewish centre and two luxury hotels. And police have been seen escorting several hostages out of the Oberoi Hotel. And Indian media is reporting that hundreds of people are still trapped there. And they report that gunmen have opened fire on the 8th floor. I'll get back to that story as we get more details on it. The Iraqi parliament has approved a security pact that will allow US troops to stay in the country for 3 more years. Factional fighting delayed the vote from yesterday, and under the new agreement, US forces must be out by the end of 2011. Now, President-elect Obama was on ABC TV last night talking to Barbara Walters about matters personal and professional. When asked about big bonuses for bank executives this holiday season, the President-elect was very direct.
If you are already worth tens of millions of dollars and you are having to lay off workers, the least you can do is say, I'm willing to make some sacrifice as well, because I recognize that there are people who are a lot less well off who are going through some pretty tough times.
President-elect Obama talking to Barbara Walters on ABC last night. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and joining us now from Mumbai is a man by the name of Aaron, who wants himself to be identified that way. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Now, you were in Mumbai as the terrifying story unfolded last night. Can you describe to me how you understood that the violence was sort of moving through the city and just how it began to envelop this entire place of 19 million people?
Yeah, we actually were at a restaurant, the restaurant that's been being mentioned called Cafe Leopold, around about 8:15 or so last night.
That's early.
We were dropped off by taxis. It was early, and we went about 100 yards or so down to a smaller cafe that was that's also in Colaba. And as we were coming out, we took a taxi that had to pass through Leopold, and there were two taxis. We were in a group of about six people, and two of them went in the first taxi past Leopold without any problem. And I was in the second group with the remaining four of us. And as we were driving towards Leopold's, I had heard two rounds of what sounded like firecrackers. The new year was a couple weeks ago here in India, so a lot of young kids have the firecrackers that we're not able to have in the States because they're illegal, and they have them here, and they're quite loud, and there are also fireworks that are consistently going off. So it's not that unheard of to have, you know, firecrackers going off. But what surprised me is that it came in rounds of three, and I immediately got kind of, you know, triggered something in me, and I forced the taxi to make an immediate U-turn. He drove over the median, and we drove in the opposite direction in Calava. And that was, by that time, I looked at my watch because one of the people in the car had to do a phone interview, and she was nervous. So I looked down at my watch, and it was 9:45. And most of the reports that are coming out over here are that things had started around 11:30, but from where we were, there were masses of people that started to gather around Leopold's at 9:45. That's when we heard the first machine guns.
Aaron, how did you get the sense of how organized and coordinated this was?
I think by the timing of things. I think we were at Leopold's and had this whole thing happen very early on. And as we were making our way further north to get back, we're actually, Mumbai is divided on the southern tip into what looks like a Y. There is a left side and a right side that are like small peninsulas, and we're on the right side. And most of this is all going on the left side. From my building, I can see the smoke from the Taj Mahal Hotel, and also the Trident. So we're just being separated by about a mile stretch of the Arabian Sea. But you can see it. You can see almost everything that's going on. You can see most of it. It actually, but from what I gathered, nothing was going on outside of this isolated incident at Leopold's.
Well, then things, of course, exploded. I'm going to let you go, Aaron,
right.
But how does it mm-hmm. feel? I mean, you were a target. You and other Westerners were a target here. I mean, that's really the terror, the center of the terror. Aaron, thanks for joining us. I know you don't want to be identified mm-hmm. fully, but you are a New Yorker in Mumbai who witnessed the terror unfolding over the last 12 hours in Mumbai. Thank you, Aaron.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We begin with the headlines from Femi OK.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big international story this morning is about terrorist attacks in the Indian city of Mumbai. They have left more than 100 people dead so far, and the terrorists targeted multiple locations around the city. So let me get you up to date with some of the latest information. Two hotels are currently surrounded by Indian forces, and a large number of police commandos are coming out of the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, where we're getting reports that 31 hostages have been rescued from the Oberoi Trident Hotel. That's the second luxury hotel currently surrounded, although unconfirmed reports are saying that maybe the hostage number is around about 60. There's a great deal of confusion about this story as we're talking about numbers. But so far, some 100 people are actually believed to be dead, 300 people were injured in this terrorist attack. Army officials say that it will take some time to make sure all the buildings targeted are completely safe.
Every room has to be searched for not only the terrorists and the human beings and the hostages. There would be a search for even explosives.
Right.
The sniffer dogs have to be taken into that part.
Right.
And even if there are any bodies which may be there, every body has to be sniffed so that there is no booby trap. So don't quantify time.
Okay.
Things are in control. People are doing a good job. You will get positive results.
And earlier this morning, the Indian Navy boarded a ship in Mumbai that had recently come from Karachi, Pakistan. They believe it is connected to the terrorist attacks, John.
Thank you, Femi. So get out your copies of the Constitution, folks, and look at that First Amendment. You're not going to find it in the fine print at all, but you may or may not have noticed that in the 21st century, freedom of speech is not necessarily something that's decided in a court of law by lawyers and legislators. No, it's something that is negotiated by people who control a complex set of pipelines and data streams that constitute the internet and things like Google, which you may or may not have known, controls 63% or more of all the search engine commands that take place around the world. And it's hundreds of millions of transactions per day. And it means that free speech is something fundamentally different today than it certainly was at the time of the framers of the U.S. Constitution, let alone anyone else who's coming to free speech maybe late in the game. Joining us to discuss the transforming evolution of free speech is Jeffrey Rosen, who's a law professor at George Washington University. And he wrote a fascinating article that appears in this weekend's New York Times Magazine about how Google, in its special relationships with countries and institutions around the world, has at least as much control over free speech as anyone else in the history of the concept. Professor Rosen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your access to the company Google was, first of all, at least as much of a reason to read this article as the fascinating premise of how rapidly free speech is changing. You open your piece with a story about what happened between Google and Turkey, something that's very much ongoing in the courts. Describe the relationship between Google and Turkey and how it bore on free speech in that country.
It's a great story because it shows just how much discretion Google has. So one morning, Nicole Wang, who's the Associate General Counsel of Google, woke up and was informed that YouTube activity in Turkey had fallen precipitously, and the Turkish government was blocking YouTube for almost all Turkish users. The government didn't realize that Google owns YouTube, so they hadn't bothered to inform Google that a Turkish judge had ordered YouTube blocked because of videos insulting Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, which is illegal in Turkey. Some Greek football fans were trying to taunt their Turkish rivals. They said in a parody of CNN, "Today's news, Kemal Ataturk was gay." This led a prosecutor to ask for a block, and the judge had blocked all of YouTube.
And so this was a sort of fraternity gag in Greece that escalated into an international incident.
Precisely right, and it resulted, without Google's knowledge, in all of YouTube being blocked and no Turkish users being able to have access to it. So Nicole Wang had to first figure out what the offending video was. She's making calls to London and Turkey in the middle of the night. She figured out it was the Ataturk video, told the Turkish government it had already been removed by YouTube users voluntarily. But by that point, the prosecutors were objecting to 67 other videos which insulted Ataturk or Turkishness. And Nicole Wang found herself at home. She said, "I don't speak Turkish, but I'm reviewing 67 videos. Some of them are Kurdish militia videos. Others are of women carrying around livestock." She had to figure out what was legal and what wasn't legal, and basically faced this very profound question of what to do about this. So what her initial instinct was to remove the videos that were clearly illegal under Turkish law, those insulting Ataturk, but to leave up those that were merely offensive but the Turkish government objected to. And for a while, this satisfied the Turkish government, but then a prosecutor made a much broader request. He said, "You can't only block the illegal videos for computers with a Turkish internet protocol address. You have to block them for the entire world, because the sensitivity of Turks around the world might be insulted."
And there's the interesting legal question that really sends us propelled right into the 21st century. Before we talk about the personality of the individuals at Google that made these decisions, it comes as a headline to me to know that Turkey actually has a switch where it can turn on and off YouTube and Google. Is that the case for nations all over the world?
Apparently, a government from the top down can essentially block access to a particular site or application to all computers with Turkish IP addresses. Now, it's not perfect, and partly because Turkish users were getting around the block that the Turkish government made a broader demand for a global block. But certainly for people who get most of their access through local services, governments can be pretty effective in blocking access.
Professor Rosen, in the time you spent with these individuals at Google, did you get the sense that they embraced enthusiastically this kind of role of being Global Committee on Free Speech and the Internet that has suddenly landed in their laps? And what was the personality of the various individuals who are making these decisions that are important for all of us?
They really don't embrace the role. I was impressed by how committed the three top decision makers are to free speech. The central character is Nicole Wang, and her colleagues jokingly call her the decider after George Bush's self-description, because she's the one with ultimate responsibility to make the call about what videos go up or come down on YouTube and which links go up or come down on Google search engines around the world. She wanted to be a journalist when she was a kid. Her aunt worked for the LA Times. But the other three top lawyers also have a journalistic background. Kent Walker, the general counsel, worked for the Harvard Crimson and wanted to be a journalist. Andrew McLaughlin, the head of public policy, is a strong civil libertarian who worked for Harvard's Berkman Center, the free expression cyber activist group. And, you know, if you had to choose people who were most committed to free speech, who you wanted to be making these decisions, these guys would be pretty high on your list.
Yet their tests for removing videos have nothing to do with the free speech tests that would come before, say, the Supreme Court, right?
Well, in America, of course, they do, because in America they have the freedom not to remove illegal activity. The central thing is that in America there's a provision of federal law that absolves Internet service providers for liability for illegal content that they post or link to. But that's not the case around the world. So even if Google wanted to impose U.S.-style free speech restrictions on the world, they can't because, as Yahoo found out in a famous case involving Nazi material, in 2001, basically, if Google does not take down links or videos that are illegal in a particular country, then their employees can be arrested on the ground and they can be held criminally liable.
Wow. Where do you think this is evolving towards? Are we in a transitional moment that's going to achieve some kind of equilibrium anytime soon?
I think it is. Remarkably, this is almost a, I don't know, you wouldn't call it a golden age for free speech, but it's certainly an age of experts where this small group of deciders is trying as hard as they can to balance free expression values with their need to obey local laws. But as they pointed out to me, there are huge pressures around the world to impose censorship from the top down, to literally build it into the network pipes. Even the U.S. government agreed recently to force internet service providers like AOL and Comcast to block child pornography at the network level. Europe wants to block terrorism videos. And basically, the Google deciders are afraid that as this top-down censorship gets built in, their ability to make these nuanced case-by-case decisions will be circumvented, and people just won't be able to have access to stuff no matter how much the intermediaries actually want it.
Well, it is certainly a moment at the beginning of the 21st century that we'll probably look back on 100 years from now, and they'll be looking at your article. Jeffrey Rosen writes about Google's gatekeepers in a piece for this weekend's New York Times magazine, where it should be noted Google is blocked in 22 countries right now. Jeffrey Rosen is a professor of law at George Washington University. He joined us from Washington. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we go, some more voices from the Indian city of Mumbai as that city calms down.
Well, we're out walking around, and so we're concerned. Of course, we're concerned for all the people and the city and India in general. It's very scary. But I don't have a sense that there's going to be another attack today, so...
Whether there is or not, we'll be following the details. Here's your takeaway, also from Mumbai.
Their deed is done. The terror that they inflict and the feeling of fear that they have instilled was that was the terror they were looking to instill.
That's Malini Agarwal, Radio 1 Mumbai presenter in Mumbai. She was caught up in those terrorist attacks last night. Of course, we're going to continue to follow the situation. Reportedly, 101 people are dead, hundreds more injured. Dozens of hostages have reportedly been released, possibly within the last hour or so. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. And if you missed anything this morning, our podcast is waiting for you, including a web-only interview about all the football today. You can find it at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So Austin Collins out there at the Plymouth Plantation in Pembroke, Massachusetts, good morning and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
This is kind of an exciting morning for you because you're a colonial reenactor, and this is a big day for reenactors. I guess you reenact the original Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you actually dress up as a pilgrim?
I do.
The big hat, the buckle, the shoes, the whole bit?
Well, not so much the buckle, but yeah. We do.
You know, I've noticed you're really covered up there, especially the women's costumes. Not a lot of skin with those pilgrim outfits, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, well, Austin, here's my problem, okay? I have three young preteen daughters, and, you know, they're getting older, and they're looking at the scanty wardrobes of your Hannah Montanas, your Christina Aguileras, your, you know, Miley Cyrus, all those. And one of my daughters even said yesterday that she thought Orlando Bloom was really hot, okay? So I'm getting kind of nervous about this teenage meteor approaching me. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Certainly.
So all I want to know, Austin, is there any evidence out there, all the reenacting you've done, the audiences who come to watch you, that young girls might go for these pilgrim outfits?
Well, some of the real young girls, like the coif, but the white cloth the women keep on their head to cover their hair.
But a teenage craze, what do you think?
I don't know.
No. Well, a daddy can dream at least. No progress for this pilgrim. I'm the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Happy Thanksgiving to all you daddy pilgrims out there. It is Thursday, November 27th. Adora Udoji is celebrating her holiday away. All that my poor preteen commiseration, but we're going to get right to the top headlines this morning. American troops now have 3 years to leave Iraq. That's the message Iraq's parliament sent just today. Lawmakers have voted to approve a security deal, putting a 2011 deadline on the American military presence. Arguments between Iraq's different religious groups delayed today's vote, and it passed with a strong majority. More than 100 are dead after the string of terrorist attacks in the Indian city of Mumbai. Heavily armed gunmen stormed a number of targets, including luxury hotels, a train station, and a Jewish organization's headquarters. They are holding hostages in several buildings as Indian commandos fight to free them. The hostage takers had specific targets.
They wanted anyone with British or American passports. Say anyone who had a British or American passport, they wanted to know. So I guess they were after foreigners, yeah?
Femi Oke is here. What is the latest? We have some hostages released.
Some hostages have escaped. Some have also been released. I'm also getting reports from Indian media that 400 hostages have been released so far.
That's a very positive
sign.
And
still going on.
Quickly on Thailand, there's a development there?
Yeah, absolutely. On Thailand, there's a state of emergency after anti-government protesters shut down two airports. The cabinet just approved an emergency order for the area around the airfields, so it allows the military to crack down bans public protests and also limits media coverage as well.
Still thousands of tourists stranded, four dead after a car bomb in Kabul, Afghanistan, exploded near the U.S. embassy, and the employees are okay, according to U.S. officials. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. We want to hear what you are thankful for today. If you're in Bangkok, if you're in Mumbai, or anywhere in the United States, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I've never seen anything so horrid. It almost felt as if Mumbai was being attacked, as if it was war. And suddenly, you could see a large number of people frantically running helter-skelter on the road.
One of many voices from the Indian city of Mumbai last night as they witnessed a terrorist attack unlike anything the city has seen. The situation is still fluid this morning. Actually, it's nightfall or dusk in Mumbai at this hour. Joining us now is Rahul Tandon, who's a BBC India correspondent in Mumbai, and also Shumit Ganguly is an expert in South Asian affairs and professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's been helping us to set all of this in context. We begin with Rahul. You're at the Taj Hotel. As we can hear, there are things happening at this moment that involve the hostages. Can you explain?
In front of me, John, at the moment, I can see a room in the Taj Hotel which is on fire. They're trying to put out the flames inside. The honest answer is We don't know who's inside it. We don't know if there are still hostages. We don't know if the hostage takers are there as well. We have, during the course of the day, seen a number of people come from within that hotel. Another luxury hotel, the Oberoi Hotel, where many Americans will have stayed, where President Clinton himself stayed when he came to India. We've seen about 14 or 15 foreigners come out of that hotel today and 12 Indians. We don't know if there are negotiations that are taking place. The head of police here in Mumbai has said he believes that the Taj Hotel, that the problems there may be getting over, but the situation at the Oberoi is extremely serious, and he has said eventually they may have to go and get people out of that hotel, dead or alive. It's almost 20 hours since Mumbai was attacked, since Americans in this city came under fire from men, we don't know the numbers of them, who had AK-47s and grenades, who just walked around the streets of Colaba, killing anybody who came in their path.
Rahul, I know you have to go, but if I could ask you, is there a sense that the authorities are keeping wraps on the details as a way of preserving security, or is it more a situation that maybe it's out of their hands, it's chaotic?
I think the latter, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, and I think when last night I'm stood by the gateway of India, one of the iconic symbols of the city of Mumbai, when the men came through that gate, heavily armed at 10 p.m. yesterday evening, we don't know how many of them that they were. And I think the authorities really at the moment are trying to deal with the situation of working out how many people are still being held in these luxury hotels. There are also reports that a Jewish outreach center, a rabbi, is being held by gunmen there along with a number of Jewish men and women. There are also reports that in an apartment complex, people are being held hostage there still 24 hours after this began. So this is an ongoing situation. I think the lack of information may be really that they're struggling to work out what to do here. They've had a very softly approach, you know, hoping that that would be the way to deal with this. I think there will come a point when people are still in these places where they're going to have to go in and get them out. And the longer it takes, the more fearful people are on the streets of Mumbai this evening. Foreigners are scared because this is the first time they've been specifically targeted. And many Indians have also lost their lives. I've spoken to business people here who said many people have not left their houses today and will not leave them until this situation is resolved. When that will be, John, we don't know.
Rahul Tandon, a very vivid sense of what's going on at the moment in Mumbai. Thanks so much for joining us. Rahul Tandon is a BBC India correspondent. Well, whether it's a chaotic standoff, as Rahul seems to be describing, or something of a mop-up operation, it's not going to be clear for several hours. Joining us to try to figure out what kind of a moment this is for the city of Mumbai and also the nation of India, Shumit Ganguly, who I introduced a moment ago. Let me remind you, he's an expert in South Asian affairs and professor of political science at Indiana University. He's on the line from Bloomington. You heard Rahul there. I mean, even in his, I mean, he's a seasoned journalist in Mumbai. They're having real difficulty in that city trying to take the measure of what's just happened.
The scale of the attack is absolutely unprecedented. In India's independent history, nothing of this order has ever happened. India has been witness to a whole series of terrorist bombings, of terrorist attacks, but never on this scale. It is the sheer size of the attack, the spread of the terrorists, the reach of the terrorists, and the places where they have struck that has instilled this degree of fear in the hearts of people.
What do you think? Let's go back and remind people of the Fedayeen, the allegations that this is a Fedayeen attack. If you could explain what that is and how that would be viewed by people in Mumbai, and what to make of these organizations that have claimed responsibility, names that have not been familiar to even security experts on South Asia.
The Fedayeen attacks are attacks which are virtually suicidal in nature, that these are people who go in not necessarily with bombs on their persons, but an attack where you have very little expectation of emerging alive. And India has witnessed attacks of this order, not of this order, but of this nature in the past, in that there was an attack in 2002 coup against an army camp at a place called Kaluchak in Kashmir. And this was a Fidayeen attack where people dressed as military personnel walked into a military base and shot basically women and children belonging to the military at will. Of course, all of them were killed in the process. In a similar fashion, there was an attack in 2006 against a prominent temple in the neighboring state of Gujarat. Again, the marauders were killed by security forces, but not before they had done considerable damage. But the scope of the present attack is what's really breathtaking, that this is not pinpointed at one location, but at multiple locations and at a iconic structure like the Taj Hotel, where I've actually stayed in one of those very sea-facing rooms. So, you know, one is forced to say, there but for the grace of God go I.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the sense of whether this is random thuggery that has certainly captured the headlines, but perhaps not much more beyond that, versus some sort of attack that really enfolds the entire city of Mumbai and perhaps suggests to the world that India's financial stability is questioned here. Where does this become an attack on financial institutions in India versus just some Westerners at a hotel?
No, I don't think this is an act of random thuggery. I think this is carefully orchestrated. The choice of Mumbai is not insignificant. It is India's, as you've correctly pointed out, is India's principal commercial hub and financial center. A very substantial portion of the country's revenue is generated by this one city of 20 million people. In addition to that, it is also India's principal entertainment capital. Much of India's soft power emanates from this, because India is the largest producer of films in the world. The Indian films are enormously popular in various parts of the world. By striking at this kind of commercial and entertainment epicenter, the people who are involved in this attack are sending a message that we can basically hold a significant portion of the country hostage, that this shows how vulnerable India is to this kind of an orchestrated a terrorist attack. This is not random thuggery by any means.
Well, we were speaking before with one of the Radio 1 presenters there in Mumbai, who did say that whatever the organization is that's behind this, the opportunity that's presented to any terrorist organization in the world of just how vulnerable, as you say, Mumbai seems to be to a handful of young men with AK-47s is likely not to be lost on other terrorist organizations. But I also spoke with a BBC editor this morning who was saying, look, we don't know if this is external. This is, in a pattern of Islamist attacks that we've seen before. Maybe the character of this is different. But let's not forget that this happens more than not in India. How do you respond to that?
That's certainly a plausible argument, but I've already been on the internet and been exchanging emails with people whose judgment I trust, who are not given to making sweeping assertions in the absence of any evidence. One of them is a very senior retired Indian diplomat, and he says that there is some evidence that these people came from the sea. Now, that does not mean that they could not be indigenous. Even indigenous terrorists could have come using the gateway of India, which is only a stone's throw from the gates of the Taj Mahal Hotel in Bombay. It's entirely possible that they are indigenous, but we should not rule out the possibility of external involvement. Well, it's just that the jury is out on the subject at the moment.
Well, Shumit Ganguly, thank you so much for helping us to set this in context. He's a professor of political science at Indiana University. Another voice from Mumbai, as someone who says how surreal it is this morning. People are going to work. They don't seem too concerned. I guess they're not the ones targeted, but still, it seems just weird. One person from Mumbai speaking to one of our news readers this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone, and happy Thanksgiving to all of you out there breaking bread and coming together. But as a reminder, for American Indians, this holiday is not a cause for celebration. It is a reminder of continued political struggle in the United States. And this was a theme that even came up during the presidential campaign this year.
So let me be clear. I believe treaty commitments are paramount law. I'll fulfill those commitments as President of the United States. That means providing quality, affordable health care, and a world-class education on reservations all across America. That will be a priority when I'm president of the United States of America.
We shall see. That was then-candidate Barack Obama speaking in May when he was adopted into a Montana Crow tribe. On a campaign stop, Obama was given a tribal name, which means one who helps people throughout the land. So for another chapter in America's briefing book, we thought we would turn to Indian Affairs and to Ben Nighthorse Campbell. He's a former senator from Colorado, the first Native American chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, one of 44 chiefs of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. He joins us from his home in Denver, Colorado. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you, John.
And do you think that Barack Obama can make good on that name, one who helps people throughout the land during his first term?
Well, I hope so. I think probably 75% of Indian voters voted for Obama, and it was really based on the promises he made. But I'm reminded of Tin Bear's famous saying 160 years ago. They made him many promises, more than I can remember, and they broke all but one. They promised to take our land, and they took it. So that comes to my mind very often when I hear promises made by Washington, D.C.
Well, what would be a signal that perhaps things are turning in a different direction in the early going? I mean, there's an appointment that would be significant, and then there are, of course, land issues.
Yeah, but I think the single most important thing right on the table has been the last couple of years, the reauthorization of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act. It's overdue something like 14 years now. It has not been reauthorized, which basically puts Indian people in the position of getting health care that was 14 years old. All the new technology they can't avail themselves to because the bill hasn't been reauthorized. I tried to get it reauthorized, and I couldn't get any help from the Bush administration. Senator Dorgan, who is now the chairman, he's trying to get it reauthorized, and it did pass the Senate, but it's now hung up in the House. So that's a very, very big one that I would hope President Obama would push for.
So the issue is dual. It's financing. There's a money question there, but then there's also an upgrading of the categories of service that are covered under the Act. They're all obsolete at this point.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it's unfortunate that it really got tied up because of an amendment that had nothing to do with Indian health care but dealt with abortion that was added to the amendment bill. And the pro-choice and the pro-life people on the House side have gotten in a big fight about it, and they've held up the whole bill. Meanwhile, Indian people continue to suffer from inadequate health care.
The other big issue that's on the table perennially for Native Americans and the Bureau of Indian Affairs is the 66 million acres of land that the federal government manages with the tribes. Mm-hmm. What's the state of that right now?
The federal government has done a terrible job of managing those lands, and that's what the Cobell litigation is all about. It's mismanaged trust fund money. And there's a big difference between what the government thinks they owe tribes and what tribal people believe is owed to them. And they may never get an actual resolution because many of the documents are lost. They estimate over 100,000 documents are missing. So it's in the courts now, and the courts so far have held that the federal government is obligated to pay. It's just working to the final solution. But I think more and more tribes are looking to the Obama administration to support them in taking over their own management of trust funds, so they can't be literally cheated out of millions and millions, if not billions of dollars of royalties of coal and gas and timber and other resources that come from tribal lands.
Theoretically, though, Senator, couldn't the Obama administration just basically, because of the court decision, just vaunt this to the top and end the conflict right now?
They could, But whatever the decision they make, the money still has to be appropriated. Courts have held in favor of the tribes, and most of the process has been working through the courts. And even if the Obama administration says, let's stop the fooling around and end this, the tribes are right, let's reach a settlement for them, you got to get the money appropriated out of Congress. And unfortunately, when you have a huge deficit, as Congress does now, and many, many players at the table, whether it's highways or states or hospitals or education or all the other things, all trying to make sure that their priorities are taken care of first, unfortunately, Indian people are way down the line.
Well, let's talk about gaming for a moment. That's an issue that, rightly or wrongly, is highly visible nationally. Has the economic downturn had an impact on tribal nations that rely on gaming revenues? Certainly Las Vegas has taken an enormous hit. I'm wondering if that's the case for Native American people.
Yes, it is. In fact, in my retirement now, one of the things I'm doing is representing the National Indian Gaming Association in Congress. Since 1988, since we passed the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, it's had huge growth. In fact, some years, Indian gaming grew by 15% per year. Last year, it only grew by 2% per year, but if you look at that compared with Las Vegas and Atlantic City, Reno, other gaming areas, the growth is still in the Indian gaming sector. It's just growing at a much smaller rate.
You know, here's maybe a more personal question. You're a former senator from Colorado, and now you're lobbying for the gaming industry for the tribes. Mm-hmm. Is all this sort of maligning talk from McCain and Obama about lobbyists, is that going to affect your access to the administration?
I don't think so. In fact, the matter is, many people that were lobbyists were working on the McCain campaign, and more than a few were also working on the Obama campaign. And in fact, some of the people that are being appointed right now in the administration have a background of lobbying. The fact is, everybody in this country, everybody, teachers, farmers, doctors, you name it, everybody has a voice in Congress, and the name of that voice is a lobbyist.
Definitely worth remembering. You want to do a memo to Barack Obama, any sort of policy advisor you would put forth to represent Indian Affairs on his staff?
Not in name, but I would hope that when he does put forth a policy advisor, it's more than just window dressing and photo ops. That's been the past many, many presidential candidates have promised to do something along that line, and it turned out to be very, very hollow in effect. So if he does appoint somebody as a policy advisor, I hope it's really going to be somebody that's going to have a seat at the table as he has promised.
Senator Campbell, thank you so much. Ben Nighthorse Campbell was the first American Indian chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He joined us as part of America's briefing book from his home in Denver. And now, the latest from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Armed gunmen have attacked at least 10 locations in Mumbai in a series of coordinated attacks. More than 100 people are dead, hundreds are wounded, and the targets included a train station, a Jewish center, and two luxury hotels as well. Now, the White House says that no Americans have been reported dead so far, and local television in India is reporting that in the last hour or so, 300 hostages have been released from one of the luxury hotels. President Bush has telephoned Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to offer support and assistance to the government of India as it works to restore order. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has asked mediator Thabo Mbeki to leave the power-sharing negotiations in Zimbabwe. He says that Mbeki, who is a former South African president, favours Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. A former First Lady Barbara Bush is doing well after ulcer surgery yesterday. The 83-year-old was admitted to a Houston hospital on Tuesday.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We'll have an update in a moment on the rapidly developing situation in Mumbai, India. There are more developments even in this hour. But here's another story from this side of the world. It's a tantalizing or bizarre echo of the Cold War, maybe. Or maybe it's a clue of the regional aspirations of this new Russia in the Western Hemisphere. But Russian President Dmitry Medvedev arrives in Cuba today after a trip to South America that included visits to Brazil and especially Venezuela. So is Medvedev's mission about mischief or something more? To find out, we spoke with BBC correspondent in Havana, Michael Voss. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Michael, I was listening to, I believe it was your report last night on the World Service, and you were describing the dedication of a Russian Orthodox church in Havana that's part of the sort of lead up to this visit by Medvedev. That was a bizarre twist.
It was a bizarre twist. It started about 4 years ago when Fidel Castro, the former president here, met a senior Russian church official, invited them to build a cathedral, a Russian Orthodox cathedral, and the Cubans paid for it. That was opened a few weeks ago, and senior Russian figures came in. There was a big trade delegation, several politicians. Now it's one more step up. It's President Medvedev. This is only the second time since the collapse of the Soviet Union that a Russian leader's been here. Former President Putin came in 2000. And as you said, I think this visit's a mix of sort of diplomacy, trade, and a bit of mischief making. Russia wants to re-establish links across the region. As you say, it's been to Brazil and Venezuela. Business, investing a bit in the region. One of the very few things actually manufactured goods that Russia's got to sell is arms. And this has partly been a sort of an arms sales mission. He's sold attack helicopters to Brazil. He's got huge, huge arms agreements with the Venezuelans and is now agreeing to nuclear cooperation. The big question with Cuba is, with a new president, with Barack Obama just elected in the United States, Cuba desperate to get rid of the decades-old trade embargo, how far will Cuba go to upset the United States for a former Cold War ally that left it in the lurch 20 years ago when the Soviet Union collapsed? The big test of this visit is whether we see any serious new military cooperation with the Russians. I think we can expect some trade and investment.
Well, what's really interesting about your reporting on this is that, as familiar as the Cuban-Russian relationship is, this relationship is also radically transformed. I mean, as you noted in the Russian Orthodox Church scene, religion now binds these two countries, where in the past both of them suppressed their respective religions. There's also some other sort of headlines popping in your region. The Nation has run an interview that Sean Penn did with Fidel, suggesting that there should be some closer cooperation or a face-to-face interview between Fidel and Barack Obama. How is that playing in Havana?
It's with great fascination. I mean, Raul Castro is a real media-shy president since he took over his brother. He doesn't like to give interviews, and for the very first interview he's given to an American, he's chosen Sean Penn. They sat together for 7 hours talking. I think it's interesting because during the election campaign, as you'll recall, Barack Obama was saying that he is prepared to talk to America's enemies, people like Raul Castro. Now we have Raul Castro saying, yes, I would like to sit down at the negotiating table with Barack Obama and sort out our differences. Interestingly, he says, let's meet at a neutral venue. He doesn't want to go to the States. He doesn't think, Barack Obama's going to want to come here. Kind of jokingly, he suggested they should meet in the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, which is here in Cuba, and sort of jokingly said, wouldn't it just? Yeah. And then sort of jokingly at the end said, and of course we could send him home with a present, the Stars and Stripes, which flies over Guantanamo Bay.
Well, fascinating stuff. I mean, you can't tell if this is orchestrated by the Cubans or Sean Penn has a movie coming out this weekend, if it's orchestrated by Hollywood to get his name in the papers.
I think what's happened here is that he had been contracted by The Nation to do an article on Chavez in Venezuela and in Cuba. And it was his contacts with the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, which got him in to Cuba, because Chavez and the Castros are the closest of allies. And I think it was President Chavez who engineered this this meeting with Sean Penn. He flew on a Venezuelan plane from Caracas to Havana for the interview.
Of course, you're denying any rumors that Sean Penn's going to be named Secretary of State in the Barack Obama administration. That's a joke, of course. One final point before we go. The Americans have been, and I wonder if you've been in touch with any of them or seen these reports, have been excruciatingly aggressive in saying they think there's nothing going on here. There's no military cooperation. There's nothing that the Russians are capable of doing here that could even alarm the Americans. Is that what you're getting?
There are one or two symbolic gestures that could happen, which I think would send the wrong signals to Washington from Cuba. As you know, there's this Russian naval fleet has sailed out from Europe to Venezuela and is going to hold joint exercises with the Venezuelans, the first time there's been any Russian warships in the Caribbean since the Cold War. Now, this is a deal with Venezuela. The question is, will they sail back through into and dock and pay a courtesy visit to Havana? I think that would send some pretty strong signals. And are they going to sign any deals? I mean, apparently the Russians have agreed to help Venezuela with nuclear technology. Now, if they did the same, if they started signing nuclear deals with Cuba, I think all sorts of alarm bells would be flashing, particularly after the missile crisis.
And Michael Voss, BBC correspondent, who joined us this morning from Havana. And now Femi Okeh has the latest.
Thank you very much, John. The time is coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Armed gunmen have attacked at least 10 locations in Mumbai in a series of coordinated attacks. More than 100 people are dead and at least 300 people injured. Western tourists have been targeted in these attacks, but one Canadian tourist says that she's still not afraid to go out.
Well, we're out walking around, and so we're concerned. Of course, we're concerned for all the people and the city and India in general. It's very scary, but I don't have a sense that there's going to be another attack today. So,
and the White House says that it doesn't know of any Americans killed in the attacks. Meanwhile, a large fire is believed to be on the 13th and 14th floor of the Trident Oberoi Hotel in Mumbai. A car bomb blew up near the U.S. Embassy in Kabul earlier today. At least four Afghans were killed, 18 people wounded. There have been a few large insurgent attacks in Kabul so far this year. One of the biggest targeted the Indian Embassy in July, leaving dozens dead. Security is tighter today on the New York City transit system. Local police boosted security following a federal intelligence warning. The advisory said that Al-Qaeda may be planning a holiday terrorist attack on mass transit and several other major cities, including Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., have upped their security as well. Let's look at some of the main stories making news this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thinking about the situation in Mumbai, whenever you stay at a hotel, one of the things the hotel tries to do more than anything else is give you a sense of safety, that you're in a sanctuary, wherever you are in the world. Hotels try to project that in terms of their architecture, in terms of their staff, in terms of everything you see in and out of a hotel. Well, that sense of safety was certainly violated in Mumbai yesterday for Alan Jones, who's a UK businessman who was in that city for 1 week, and here's his near escape from the Trident Hotel.
We were basically dining at the Trident Hotel. We're actually residents there for this week. We left the restaurant at about 5 to 10 and took the lift up to the top of the Trident Hotel. There was a bar there, but that was closed.
It was a trip in an elevator that would be very, very fateful. The bar was closed, but that was not the only thing that didn't work out as Alan expected.
We took the lift back down to the lobby. On the way back down with us, two Japanese gentlemen entered the lift on about the 16th floor. As the lift got to the lobby, the doors opened. We heard banging in the lobby as one of the Japanese gentlemen walked out to see what was happening and immediately signaled that we should get back in the lift.
signaled because there was violence everywhere. Alan continues the story.
He was shot as he got back into the lift. I believe just once, but it may have been twice, because he looked hurt before what I saw was a gunshot in the back of his leg. I was pressing the closed door button on the lift, trying to get the lift to go up away from the lobby, but his foot was actually stopping the doors from closing, so I had to kneel down as the gunman approached the lift and pull his foot back in.
So imagine, in a matter of minutes, from safety, hunting for a bar at the end of an evening, to actually being under siege in an elevator with one person who's wounded, whose limb is actually keeping the door from being closed, and a gunman approaches the elevator.
The doors managed to close, take us back up. He insisted on getting out at the 16th floor where he'd gone. We tried to persuade him to go to the 28th floor where we're staying, and we knew there'd be staff there. We told staff there'd been an attack. It was obvious to see because there was blood all over the lift. We were showered in blood and flesh as we got out of the lift. We went to our room, so obviously locked the door. 5 minutes later, staff came to the room and told us that we should take the staff lift down to the basement of the hotel where there's a ballroom.
So from a sense of safety, now Alan and his companion are wounded, and they have no idea where to go.
For about an hour, we were in the ballroom, and then we were led out in groups of 10, running across the back street to a safe area, what was described as a safe area, but there were no police or anything like that. There. It was just many people just gathered together.
At this point, the various reports from Mumbai give the death toll at between 87 and 101. The number of hostages is still unknown at this hour. But it's safe to say that Alan Jones, a businessman from the UK, his experience there is typical of a sense of safety that 19 million people had ripped from them as terrorists took over Mumbai and are still at this hour continuing to terrify that city of 19 million.
As we left the hotel, we had absolutely no idea what was going on.
Alan Jones told his story to the BBC, our partners.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And we begin with Femi Okay and the headlines. Femi?
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. And in India, in the southern city of Mumbai, the time is 17 minutes past the hour. One of the luxury hotels that's been held siege by gunmen, the flames from the hotel seem to be under control. Terrorist attacks on the Indian city of Mumbai have so far left more than 100 people dead. And the terrorists actually targeted multiple locations around the city. So let me get you up to date with the latest information. The two hotels are still surrounded by Indian forces. And right now, Indian media is actually reporting that at least 300 people have been released so far. And India is a wired country, and many in Mumbai are sharing information using microblogging services like Twitter. That's a service where you actually use your mobile phone to communicate. But the real-time nature of the medium has some people worried that terrorists may be using it for information, and some bloggers are encouraging Twitter users to be careful about sharing information that could help terrorists. Iraq's parliament has voted by a large majority to approve a plan for the withdrawal of US troops from the country by the end of 2011 and for their powers to be severely curtailed from the beginning of next year. Now, arguments between rival factions delayed the measure. There was even a mini protest as the Speaker of the House announced the vote. So the Speaker is saying in Arabic, now we vote on the parliament's resolution. Have a listen to the effect from the MPs. They're actually yelling no, no to the pact. They're holding up banners and they're shouting yes, yes to Iraq. So you can see why it took so long to negotiate the pact over a year of negotiations. The deal must now be ratified by the Presidential Council, but it is expected to approve it. John.
Thank you, Femi. So people who have lived in the White House often talk about the awesome power of the presidency. But in fact, there are very few presidential powers that are absolutely awesome and unquestioning and unchecked in any way. And the only one that really is, by my standards, awesome is the power to pardon. Presidents can pardon anyone for any reason, and there's no recourse. There's no action that can be taken to reverse that pardon. It's written right there in the Constitution. And talking about pardons, with us this morning is P.S. Ruckman Jr. He's the editor of the Pardon Power blog. He's author of the forthcoming book, Pardon Me, Mr. President, Adventures in Crime, Politics, and Mercy. P.S. Ruckman joins us from DeKalb, Illinois. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, John.
So it's fair to say this is the pardon season, with an outgoing administration actually announcing some names already. What do you make of the Bush pardon so far?
Well, he's exercised the power very little in comparison with previous presidents. But in a lot of ways, he's going as expected. He's a former governor. He's a Republican. He followed a pardon controversy. In those circumstances, presidents tend to pardon less. And so in that sense, he's been somewhat predictable.
Is it true what I'm saying, that the pardon power is really awesome? It's absolute. It's one of the few real constitutional kind of superpowers.
Well, you have the constitutional restriction that a pardon can't be related to impeachment, and the president can't pardon someone for a state offense. And traditionally, presidents haven't been able to pardon people, or at least they weren't willing to pardon people who are dead. But other than those things, yes, it seems to be an absolute power. And we have the Supreme Court, frankly, to blame for that.
Because?
Well, because of an early opinion in the 1830s where John Marshall interpreted the power, frankly, in a manner that was more broad than the King of England. Even the King of England had restrictions on the pardon power. It's not really clear how many the president has.
Can the president pardon Charles Manson, or is that, I guess, a state offense?
Yeah, it's a state offense.
It's a state offense, so he couldn't do it. But he could pardon John Hinckley.
Sure.
I suppose if he wanted to. Right, right.
And you know, it sounds kind of bizarre on its face, but many bizarre things have happened in the world of executive clemency.
Well, let's hear some kind of pardons run amok stories, if you got any.
Well, I mean, since you mentioned John Hinckley, several of the conspirators or co-conspirators in the Lincoln assassination were pardoned. The individual who formed the plot, the individual who held the door open for John Wilkes Booth to escape, and the individual who set John Wilkes Booth's leg, all those individuals were recipients of federal executive clemency.
From Andrew Johnson?
Yes, yes.
Really?
Oscar Collazo, who attempted to assassinate Harry Truman, had his death sentence commuted to life in prison, and then Jimmy Carter released him. And then three individuals who sprayed the House of Representatives with the bullets and hit five representatives had their sentences commuted by Jimmy Carter as well. So, you know, you say Charles Manson, it sounds like, you know, well, that'd be the most bizarre thing that would ever happen. Actually, it wouldn't. Add to the list, Lupo the Wolf, Ignacio Sayeti, who ran the murder stable up in New York City, tortured, murdered 60 different people, who was a recipient of executive clemency. So stranger things have happened.
Who pardoned the wolf?
I believe that was Calvin Coolidge.
Calvin Coolidge.
It wasn't a pardon. It was a commutation of sentence. There were little politics going on trying to get rid of him, actually.
So I guess it's safe to say that pardoning the backup singer to Carly Simon on cocaine distribution charges is probably not going to make it into the, you know, big history books?
Well, my position is that every generation has had unforgettable pardons. They seemed unforgettable at the time. But as the years have gone by, we have forgotten them. So whatever Bush does, my bet would be not too far down the road, no one will remember, or very few will.
Do you sense any sort of pattern from the Bush pardons? I mean, there's the unauthorized use of a pesticide charge, a pardon for that, unauthorized use of food stamps, unauthorized use of fertilizer. I don't really see a pattern here.
Well, there's a little bit of a skew toward drug offenses, but that makes sense because there's so many drug offenses in the federal system. What he's done typically is pardon people who committed offenses many, many years ago. They've served their time, and he's granted, of course, pardons as opposed to commutations. And so, yeah, there are a few patterns in there, but Nothing too terribly risky, that's for sure.
Has anybody used the presidential pardon power? And in my reading of the Constitution, and I'm no constitutional scholar by any means, my reading of the pardon power is that it's reserved for some sort of dramatic redress of a miscarriage of justice. Has anyone ever used it in a really dramatic way?
To redress a situation where someone was found to be innocent? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, just someone who was a cause celeb who the president stepped up and actually pardoned. It seems to me it's much more for little details.
Well, at the very beginning of history, Washington pardoned the Whiskey Rebels. That was widely considered to be a very popular pardon because people thought treason was just too serious of a charge for what those individuals did.
And we should remind people the Whiskey Rebellion took place in New England, and it was an opposition to the newly created U.S. federal government, which was taxing producers of whiskey, and they didn't like it very much at all and declared war.
I think the pardon of Eugene Debs, too, had kind of a feel to it that, many people thought, he'd been punished enough. And although he wasn't the most popular person in the world, there was a sense that exercising mercy in his case was, the right thing to do, perhaps.
When did that happen with Eugene Debs?
That's in the Harding administration.
Harding administration. And Harding, who, doesn't have much of a legacy, certainly that's one of the historical details that is very much in the first paragraph.
But if you're looking for, popular pardons, there definitely have not been many of them. Because after all, you are pardoning criminals. And,
right.
That allows for all sorts of criticism from individuals who are, watching what you're doing.
But it is the get-out-of-jail-free card, and it's written there in the Constitution. P.S. Ruckman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
P.S. Ruckman, Jr. is the editor of the Pardon Power blog and author of the forthcoming book, Pardon Me, Mr. President, Adventures in Politics, Crime and Mercy. And before we go, we're going to leave you with a few more voices from the city of Mumbai, where that situation is still developing.
My friend said, tell them you're Italian or something if they come up to you, So I was there with my hands up just thinking, basically I was in, serious trouble.
Two of the men at one end kept opening the doors, which was absolutely terrifying, and going back out and coming back in, and they were saying there was a dead body out beside the bathroom, and also they were seeing people getting shot in the hallway.
And your takeaway this morning comes from the situation in India.
The scale of the attack is absolutely unprecedented. In India's independent history, nothing of this order has ever happened.
That's Shumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Indiana University, talking about the terror attacks in Mumbai, helping to set them in context. Before we go, Femi, okay, what's the situation?
Almost 8:30 now in Mumbai, 104 people dead, 300 injured, no Americans as far as we know in that tally, 8 militants dead. And right now, the Indian security forces are trying to take full control of 2 hotels and a Jewish center. There are still some hostages in one of the hotels.
So we will continue to follow that situation as more information emerges. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. What food are you going to leave untouched on today's Thanksgiving table?
Yeah, this is Toby Monroe from Claremore, Oklahoma. If I had to throw away any Thanksgiving item, it would probably have to be store-bought pumpkin pie.
Well, don't throw away anything. Try to recycle it, won't you? If you've missed any of the breaking news from Mumbai or our Thanksgiving stories this morning, you can catch up on all of it with our podcast. Subscribe via iTunes or on our website, thetakeaway.org. We have a web-only interview on all the football action today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.